Welcome to Christchurch Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com.
My home is not on this earth, not in this world.
Right, let's hit the ground running. We're going to read from Mark 3, 7 to 19, which should appear up behind me. And you can follow along with me in your Bibles, and we'll then be working our way through. So it's worth having your Bible in front of you. So let's do it. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed from Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea, which is how you say it, and from beyond the Jordan and from Tyre and Sidon. When the great crowd heard all that he was doing, they came to him, and he told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, lest they crush him. For he had healed many, so that all who had diseases pressed around him to touch him. And when the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." And he strictly ordered them not to make him known. And he went up on the mountain, and he called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. And he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him, and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. He appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is, Sons of Thunder. And they went on to form a heavy metal band. Andrew, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. So these are, it's just a fascinating passage, this, with some incredible little details here, but really about Jesus standing up to power, about Jesus bringing about his kingdom. And Mark, as he tells us these stories, he gives us little details which tell us about a much bigger story, about how actually Jesus was going to stand up to power, about how he was going to bring about a huge change, about how his kingdom would break out across the world. And if we think about it, about 50 years after this event, his people, his church, had spread across Europe, were into Asia, were into North Africa as well. Something clicked and changed, which meant this small gathering exploded out. And now, a few thousand years later, across the whole planet. So today, I want us to think about how he did that. And I think he stood up to power, quite simply, and he gathered a team. He stood up to power, and he gathered a team. So let's look at what he did. Rich, could you get me a water yourself? Thanks, man. So, if you want to make a change, if you want to see something in society change, you have to stand up to power, like we've said. You have to stand up to those who are in authority. And really, Jesus was beginning the process of doing that. He was beginning a revolution, you could say. And revolutions are notoriously very, very tricky when you stand up to power. And ultimately, when you do that, there is often bloodsheds and significant upheaval. Excuse me. So if you look at the French, the American, the Russian, any of the revolutions which were in the British Empire where they were standing up to us, you stand up to the power, but it's a difficult thing to do. It will often involve bloodshed and significant upheaval. And actually, Jesus' revolution was no different. It involved bloodshed. It involved his own bloods. And also involved significant upheaval and change across our whole planet. And it's important to understand that. So Jesus started this off by standing up to power. So who did he stand up against? And actually, Mark, just as he tells this little story of Jesus withdrawing to the seaside, with his disciples, actually he gives us a few clues about the different powers Jesus was standing up against. So in verse 7, it says, he withdrew with his disciples to the sea and a great crowd followed him. So you think, okay, well that's an interesting detail. And it's possibly a subtle dig from Mark, these great crowds. Well, this follows a story about the Pharisees, and we looked at that last week. And something interesting about the Pharisees is they did not have great crowds. Okay, and actually, Jesus would say, you Pharisees will travel miles for one convert. Well, Jesus didn't have to go very far, and actually loads of people followed him. So Jesus was standing up to a religious elitism and legalism. That was a power that he was going up against. And where the Pharisees had to travel miles in order to find anyone who might follow them, actually, wherever Jesus went at this stage, huge crowds followed him. Crowds that were so big, actually, Jesus was genuinely worried they might crush him and kill him by accident. So he organizes that he can stand on a boat by the sea so that people can just be a step back from him so that he can actually teach them, because so many people wanted to be there. The Pharisees never had this problem. So what powers did Jesus want to stand up against? Well, he wanted to stand up against elitism and kind of religious legalism as well. And that was very important. He also wanted to stand up to Herod the Tetrarch. Okay, now you might think, what on earth has got this got to do with us? Well, let's just read about this for a minute. So it says, from these different regions, Galilee, Judea, Jerusalem, Idiom, from Jordan, from around Tyre, and from around Sidon, all of these people were gathering to Jesus. Lots of them were gathering to him. Now, Herod the Tetrarch is the son of Herod the Great. And when Herod the Great was giving inheritance, he would say, right, you, Herods, they're all called Herod, which makes it confusing, you will take over from me. But on his deathbed, he changed his mind and gave him only a quarter of Israel. And actually, Tetrarch means a quarter. So effectively, this kid is called Herod the Quarter, which, you know, is a little bit... His dad was called Herod the Great. He is called Herod the Quarter. That's slightly underwhelming for him. But he was a power-hungry local bully. So he only got a quarter of Israel, and a lot of his reign was about trying to get more of it back again. But Jesus, just in this little statement about where people came from, they actually traveled a long way from all over Israel, and not just the current Israel, but all over from kind of Israel at its greatest. They came to see him. And it's a bit of a statement here saying, actually, Jesus is gathering the whole people of God back together again. And he doesn't need to go after them. They are rushing to him. So when we look at this Herod, we see Jesus is going up against nationalism and greed, actually. He is going up against the idea of the inadequate kings of Israel, who actually were for wealth. They were for power. And Jesus is going up against that. He is standing up against that power as well. And who else was he standing up against, or what else? Well, Mark keeps telling us this story, and he says, look, these crowds were coming to Jesus because he healed. It says he healed many. And Jesus is very different because he is not self-serving like Herod was, like the Pharisees were. Actually, he was looking to heal and bless those on the fringes, those on the edge of society, those who were powerless. And to be ill in that day and in that culture meant actually you would quickly drop out of society. There was no welfare state to look after you particularly. You would rely on your family if you had family. And actually, because you were ill and couldn't earn money, you would actually start making the whole family poorer and poorer. And Jesus is there for those people. And also in this, we see that Jesus ruled over the physical world. So he is actually standing up against disease, against illness. He didn't just rule over the kind of the leadership political world. Actually, he ruled over the physical world. And we see this as we read through the gospel. We read that Jesus changed the physical world just by his command. Whether that's he changed the weather, or he turned small bits of bread into lots of bread, or people who were dead, he brought them back to life. Those that were very sick, he restored them. Jesus is standing up against the powers which cause those things. And what are those powers? Well, actually, Mark keeps going and he says, whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him. So Jesus stands up against the forces of evil. So he stands up against religious elitism and legalism. He stands up against local politicians who are bullies, who are nationalists, who are very greedy, who want to take from the poor. He stands up against illness, disease, poverty. And he also stands up against the evil that goes behind that. And we in the West, we can struggle with this idea a little bit. We like to understand what's in front of us, which we can see, we can tangibly understand and maybe touch and taste and study. But actually, throughout the Gospel of Mark, he kind of parts the curtains a little bit and lets us glimpse behind into the spiritual world, which is there. And behind that, we see actually behind sin, behind suffering, behind greed, behind the nationalism that he stood up against, evil lurks there. Evil it has control there. And actually, Paul wrote about this when he talked about the armour of God in Ephesians. He says, look, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. We don't wrestle against other people, other humans. And he probably wrote that because the church he was writing to, they were worried about people attacking them. He said, look, it's not the people that are attacking us that we wrestle with. Actually, it's against rulers, authorities. It's against cosmic powers. It's against darkness. It's against spiritual forces of evil. That's what Paul wrote. He said, look, actually, we don't go up against people. It's what's behind these things that we go up against. For Jesus to see the world change, for his revolution to kick into gear, actually, to go up against the power, he goes up against evil. To see his kingdom advance, you have to deal with the current kingdom that's in power. And Jesus stands up to that. And also, finally, Mark points out that he stands up to Caesar. So these evil spirits, they cry out and they say, you are the Son of God. And Son of God was how the Caesars at the time, the leaders, the rulers of the Roman Empire, was how they were beginning to refer to themselves as. They were trying to give themselves some divinity to try and make themselves look better. And it kind of started with Augustus, who was the Caesar when Jesus was born. And actually, the Gospel of Mark was quite probably written in Rome. Some of the first people that read it were the Roman church. And so when they read this, our evil spirits call him the Son of God. They would have heard this language before about the rulers and kings of Rome. And actually, Jesus stands up to the most powerful humans in the world. And sometimes, actually, we can watch the news, we can look at leaders of state, and we can feel unsettled by some of the things they talk about, particularly at the moment where very right-wing leaders who actually appear to be quite oppressive say things. And we can be concerned about that, but we need to know that Jesus goes up against them as well. And importantly, he goes up against what's behind them, the evil that lurks there. And Jesus stood up to power. And he causes actually a whole world of trouble when he does that. He is standing up against the most significant powers, and those powers want to be worshipped. They want to have control, and they are prepared to kill so as that they can hold on to that. And yet Jesus goes up against those things. And how does he do that? And actually, Mark kind of carries on the story and challenges us a little bit here. How does Jesus stand up to power? Well, what might we expect someone to do in this situation? Now, if you think about in recent history when our politicians and leaders have talked about regime change, okay, we might think of Iraq, for example, where America and the UK said, we want a change of regime there. And how would they do that? Well, they would try and build an army and gather the most rich and powerful and influential with them to bring that about. And in a funny way, the disciples at the time were kind of expecting something a bit similar. I think, actually, well, Jesus is going to become the new king of Israel. So that Herod guy we were talking about, Jesus will replace him. The physical area of Israel will be restored. We will be free, probably from the Romans. Jesus will be the king of that empire as a political leader, will then run the country. That'll be how it works. But actually, Jesus had something very, very different in mind. He knew that when you stand up to power, actually, there is bloodshed. He knew that the blood spilled would be his. But he also knew that actually, for this kingdom to advance over time and over the future history, actually, it needed to go beyond him. He needed to have more people involved. And so he gathers a team that will stand up to power. So how does he do that? Well, first of all, he goes up a mountain. Verse 13, it says, "And he went up on the mountain and called." Now, we might think, okay, he went down to the sea, then he goes up to the mountain. It's just Jesus was just walking around. Let's not read too much into that at all. But actually, in the Bible, mountains are often where God is. And it often happens when there's a reference to a mountain, you need to think, okay, mountains are where God is. And particularly the Old Testament, people would often encounter God on a mountain. And specifically, and this is what I think this is kind of referencing, Moses would encounter God on the mountain. So in Exodus 19, God brings Israel out of Egypt. He brings them out of slavery with lots of great miracles and plagues. And he brings them out to be his people. He said, "I want you to be my people. You're going to worship me, and I will be your God, and I will bless you." That's what happens. That's the plan for bringing them out of Egypt. So he brings them out. They're in the desert. He gets them to Mount Sinai. He calls them there. And specifically, he calls Moses up the mountain. And he said to Moses, "Look, I'm going to give you a message for Israel. You need to go and tell the people this." So Moses listens, and God says, "Tell them, if you obey my voice, if you keep my covenant, so keep my law, you shall be my treasured possession, a kingdom," is that word again, "a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Okay, Moses, you go and tell the people of Israel that. That's what I've said. So Moses goes down the mountain, passes on the message, and all the people go like, "Yeah, okay, we'll do that. That's good. Sounds good to us." And then God instructs them all to stay off the mountain. Fascinating passage. Stay off the mountain. Don't go on it. It'll kill you. But Moses gets to go back up again. And then God comes down in this big cloud and gives him the Ten Commandments, gives him the law. And this is a key moment in Israel's history. This is the kind of their founding moments. This is where they as a people become God's people. They become the people of God's kingdom. So when we talk about the kingdom of God, we talk about his rule, his reign, him being in charge. But for a kingdom to really exist, it needs a people that God is in charge of and is their God. And this is what happens. Israel becomes God's people. So when Mark says Jesus went up a mountain, it's not a throwaway comment. It's not like he got lost. It's not like he was at the sea and thought, "You know what? I'm done with the sea. I quite fancy a hill walk. That's what I'm going to do." Actually, it's a very, very deliberate thing. And in this, we see Mark saying Jesus is a little bit like Moses in this moment because he's led the people out of slavery. Okay, he's led them out to be with God. But also, Jesus is a bit like God. He calls the people to the mountain and he makes them his people, like God did with Israel. So Jesus appoints 12 disciples, and Israel was made up of 12 tribes. So Jesus is forming this new kingdom, and this kingdom now needs a people. So verse 13 says, "He went up the mountain, he called to him those whom he desired." So he called those he wanted, and they came to him. I don't know if you ever think about your faith in that way. Sometimes we just kind of, you kind of stumble through it and just, you just keep going and you plod in your faith. But actually, you're here because Jesus wants you. It's a funny thing, isn't it? Think, actually, Jesus called to him those whom he wanted. And sometimes we read this and think about, what about the people he didn't call? Well, it's nothing there about that. He just says he called those whom he desired. This morning, you may have had to battle through breakfast with little children, or you may have had a difficult week, or you may have had a brilliant week, or whatever it might be. But actually, you're not here by accident. You're not in the people of God by mistake. You're here because Jesus desired for you to be here. Jesus called you into his presence. And it says he appointed the 12. And the word that we use for appointed almost works, but it's more like he made them. It's almost like a creative act. He made his disciples. And it's a funny way to think about the people he wanted. Like, well, you there, I want you, you come here. But actually it was you come here and I make you. I make you into what I want you to be. This isn't just a title, an official role. Actually, he makes them into something. When we think about our faith, it's sometimes worth thinking, actually, I was made by Jesus for Jesus. And sometimes we think, well, I've got nothing to bring to this equation. I'm a bit useless and rubbish. Well, the things I try don't work. Well, Jesus made you for him. Made you into a nation. Made you into God's people. Actually, to represent God's people to the world. You remember what he said to Israel in Exodus? You are to be a holy nation, a royal priesthood. Actually, you represent me to the rest of humanity, the rest of creation. Peter himself writes in one of his letters, he says, actually, the church is a holy nation, a royal priesthood. That's what you are when you are God's people. Jesus calls you. And actually, in Mark, this isn't the first time Jesus calls his people out. See, in the first chapter of Mark, he says to them, look, follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. And at that point, they walk away from their boats, they walk away from their jobs, and they start to follow Jesus. But this time, Jesus is kind of fleshing out a little bit more. Okay, this is what's going to happen. This is what it's going to look like. This is a little bit of my succession plan as to what will follow. So Jesus calls you because he wants you, because he desires you to be involved. But when he does, it's a little bit messy. And we need to be honest about this. There is some mess here, okay? So verses 16 to 19, it kind of just looks like a list of names. These are, okay, it's the 12 disciples. We all know those. Perhaps you did them in Sunday school. But there are little bits of information here which explain to us that this was a bit chaotic and a bit messy. And these guys were not great, if we're honest. They were not great. And Mark is dropping very big hints for us in the details, actually. So let's start with Simon, who Jesus changes his name to Peter. We think, that's a strange thing. Why would you do that? Peter was, it kind of meant the rock. Okay, now when you read this, you from distance over thousands of years, you think, well, that's because the church was built on Peter. You think, well, yes, maybe. But actually, think about the people that knew Peter, who would then have read this, and would have remembered what Peter was like. And actually, as you read all the way through Mark, you'll see that Peter was not very rock-like. Confrontational, actually, was Peter. Quite impulsive. At one point, he sees Jesus, dives off a boat to swim to him. He was kind of quite impulsive, but also quite competitive. He was quite keen on looking better than the other disciples. Also, Peter was prone to quite significant acts of violence. Remember the time he swung a sword at a guy's head and cut off his ear. And then at the end of Jesus' ministry, Peter is nowhere to be seen and denies that he knew him. That's what being a rock is. Okay, so it's Peter. Then we have James and John, sons of thunder, they're called. And why were they called that? Well, it appears that they had some issues with temper control. They were relatively short-tempered, shall we say. And at one point in Jesus' ministry, they suggest to Jesus that he calls fire down on a village who didn't do what Jesus wanted them to do. So, Jesus, they didn't do what you said. Kill them all. Okay, short-tempered, possibly. Then there's Matthew, or Levi, as he would have been known as well, who was a tax collector, which also meant he was a fraudster, so he stole money, and was a stooge of the Roman Empire. Okay, so that's someone else that Jesus chose. Then there's this guy, Bartholomew, who in John's Gospel is referred to as Nathanael. We think it's probably the same guy. And he was quite clearly very cynical and snobbish and elitist. It's another one of Jesus' top crew there. And then then we have Thomas. Thomas, who we now know as Doubting Thomas. That's how much of a faith-filled guy he was. Followed Jesus around for 3 years. Remember, saw astounding miracles. Walking on water, for example. Raising the dead. Feeding thousands and thousands of people. And at the end of it all, he still wasn't quite convinced. Okay, that's Thomas. Then there is Simon the Zealot. And the Zealots were a radical nationalist group who supported a violent uprising. A little bit like Al-Qaeda, shall we say. So that was another one of his guys there, Simon the part-time terrorist. And then finally, top of the tree is Judas. Judas was in charge of the disciples' money, and he stole it regularly, and also betrayed Jesus to his death at the end of it all. That was Jesus' first team. That was his top crew. That was how Jesus planned to stand up to power. And I don't know about you, but I find that oddly reassuring. What a bunch of failures. I think I might get into that team. So if you ever feel like, actually, you know what, I just don't bring much to the party. I turn up at church. I do my best to get to community group. I do my best to, you know, try to live a good life. Actually, there was that time at work when somebody wanted to talk about faith and I completely fluffed it. Or there was that time someone was sick and I knew I should pray for him, but I didn't because I was scared of being embarrassed. I'm owning up to that one. I've done that a number of times. Or perhaps you feel like God said some stuff to you and you could have bought it and prayed for someone, but again you were a bit shy and you decided to back off. Maybe when you look at the list of those disciples you think, yeah, I lose my temper really quite easily. Or actually, you know what, I'm really competitive. I like it when other people fail and it makes me look good. I quite enjoy that situation. And then you think all of those things are true for you, and yet Jesus still wants you. Jesus still calls you to the mountain of God's to be in his presence. So why does he do that? Well, I'll go back a few verses. Verse 14 says he appointed them. Remember, he made them. They were his people. He made them. He called them the disciples, or they were also called the apostles, which means being sent. And he said, why did he make them? So that they might be with him. That was it. Why have you called me here? So we can be together. So you can be with me. We can know each other. We can spend some time together. There was a whole bunch of training that happened in those few years. Remember, they went through all of that training, and then at the end of it, they still deserted or doubted or betrayed. I remember that. But they were with him. When we think, how do we overthrow the powers that we see in our society? When we look at the world around us, perhaps when we look at the difficulty and trouble that is in the world, what are one of the ways we can overthrow that power, stand it up to that power? Well, we can know Jesus. We can be with him. That's a great place to start. You think, well, how do I do this? How do I grow in my faith? How do I find my place as one of Jesus' disciples? Well, first thing is you can know him. You can talk to him, spend time with him, be in his presence. And it's that simple. And actually, he calls you and he wants you there. You don't have to drag yourself there. Jesus wants you to be there. And then he says, so he might be with me and that I might send them out to preach. So it doesn't mean, right, you're all going to go and preach like you do on a Sunday, have a 30-minute sermon, which will take a number of hours to construct, and then you will deliver it, and with any luck, you'll get over 100 listens on the podcast. That's what you're after. And that's not what he means. Actually, when you're with your friends, your family, perhaps someone asks a question and you can lead into that question. You can maybe have read your Bible a bit and think, actually, you know what, I can talk you through this. We can have a conversation. Perhaps it's with someone at work, just in a lunch break. They just open up a little bit about what's going on in their life. And you can listen to them and you can maybe tell them a little bit about your faith and what you believe. And in that moment, you preach to them. Perhaps it's with your little kids and just deciding that you're going to try and read the Bible with them, which sometimes you have to kind of gaffer tape them to a chair to get them to sit still long enough that you can read to them or read with each other. But in that moment, you're preaching. Perhaps it's with friends and you're in the pub and they open up a little bit about stuff that's going on and you can share with them a bit what's happened in your life. In those moments, you're preaching. And Jesus sent you to do that. So it doesn't matter how well or not well it goes. Actually, Jesus sent you to do that. And what else? He sent them out to preach and finally have authority to cast out demons. Jesus gives you authority. That's an important word to understand. Think about all of the powers that Jesus was standing up against, whether it's religious elitism or political bullies, whether it was Caesar, who looked like he was the god of the whole world, in fact, looked like that so much he kind of called himself that, or whether it's the evil that kind of underpins all of those things. What does Jesus give you? Well, he gives you authority to cast those things away. We're to remember that we are not up against flesh and blood. We're not battling with humans here. Actually, we have authority over evil. It's like a very grand thing to say. When you think, cast out demons, and am I supposed to go full exorcist? How does this work? Well, actually, how you live your life, how you choose to be with Jesus, how you choose to worship him, actually will give you the opportunity to stand up for good and not bad. And in those moments, you have some authority. When you look to pray for people, for them to be better, to be healed, or you pray for them for things in their life. We were praying this morning in the prayer meeting for different issues that are going on in people's lives. And actually, in those moments, we get to have authority over evil by saying, Jesus, we want your plan to happen, not the opposition's plan. We stand up to evil. And Jesus calls you up the mountain of God to be with him so that you can do all of that. So Jesus' great plan for the revolution, his great plan to stand up to power, the powers that be in this world, is to gather you, regardless of how good you feel, and look at the disciples. They were largely incompetent, and he turned them into a church that spread very quickly across Europe, across into Asia, into North Africa, and now thousands of years later it keeps spreading. We keep having that work to do, and Jesus calls you to do that. It's pretty easy, I think, to rule ourselves out. And actually, it's a bit comforting to do that because it means we can take a step or two backwards to think, well, I'm not good enough, which is what the Pharisees would say about you. I'm not good enough. I can't do those things. I've done all of these things in my life. I've got this going on in my life. And actually, I think as Mark writes out this list of names, he was saying, look what these people did. Look what God has used them for. Actually, we are that as well. We are that holy nation, that royal priesthood. We are on the mountain of God, called there by Jesus, so actually we can be sent out. So actually we can stand up to power.